Odyssey celebrates National Hispanic Heritage Month, brought to you by T-Mobile. You can count on T-Mobile to help you stay connected on America's largest 5G network.
We're back live with more Anthony Herron on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Dude at three for Tiffany Mitchell.
Connecticut, second last in the league in three-point percentage, just under 29%. Clark heaves and rattles one in. Back and forth they go from deep.
Final score of that game, the Indiana Fever and the Connecticut Sun, just ended not too long ago. Connecticut wins by 17 over Caitlin Clark and the Indiana Fever, 89-72. That was a three-pointer that Clark hit in the game. Numbers unimpressive for Caitlin Clark in this one, 10 points in the game. Ended up with two assists. What'd she go? 2 out of 5 from three-point range, 3 out of 8. From the field in 22 minutes. And, you know, certainly the schedule the Indiana Fever have played has been extremely difficult throughout the season so far. They've pretty consistently faced some of the top teams in the WNBA. So now the Fever 3-10 on the season, 2-6 away from home. This is another road loss for Caitlin Clark and the Fever. But as much as Caitlin Clark has dominated headlines in recent weeks, and especially in that layoff period before the NBA finals and the NHL finals weren't going on yet, it was like, all right, either you want to talk baseball or you want to talk Caitlin Clark. That was kind of the only two main topics that were out there, unless you wanted to cover a little bit of minicamp news around the National Football League. So there was a lot that was going on there in discussing Caitlin Clark after the Fever played the Chicago Sky. And Kennedy Carter had the cheap shot on Clark, put her on the deck. And there were so many reactions to that. And so now the newest reaction has come with the news on the Team USA women's basketball roster as America prepares for the Paris Olympics. The globe prepares for the Paris Olympics. And Caitlin Clark, who was a part of the pool of players that had the opportunity to make Team USA, that were being considered and had the potential to make Team USA, she was not amongst the final selections that actually ended up making the roster for the Olympic Games for Team USA. You know, Team USA women's basketball, they're even well beyond the men in their dominance of international basketball, and especially gold medal after gold medal that they tend to win. Women's basketball has certainly become an international sport, but far and away the best players on the planet are still the women from the United States. And so whether Caitlin Clark ended up being on the roster or did not, in this case she did not end up making the Team USA roster, they're going to win the gold regardless. But there was a lot of reaction to the news that Caitlin Clark did not end up getting selected for Team USA. And part of the conversation coming into this choice was whether or not she would get consideration based off her immense popularity and whether or not her game itself would warrant being on Team USA. And before she had taken a dribble in the WNBA, part of the reporting was that there'd be an opportunity in the midst of the early portion of the WNBA season to evaluate Caitlin Clark against the other best players in the world and just see whether or not her game would end up being worthy of that. It's really not there yet. You know, as far as viewing her amongst the top 12 United States women's basketball players that are there, but a lot of other conjecture about whether or not the decision from Team USA ended up making sense based off the opportunity to continue expanding the brand of the sport and utilizing the popularity of Caitlin Clark and her addition to Team USA. Is that something that just USA women's basketball should have capitalized on, regardless of whether or not she was viewed as one of the best players? I'll give you my thoughts on that particular point in a moment. But let's hear from Caitlin Clark herself. The news came out over the weekend, and she was asked about it and described how the news, the delivery of that news went down with her and what was her reaction to it.
Caitlin, what was your reaction when you saw the USA team yesterday, the roster come out?
Yeah, I think I'm excited for the girls that are on the team. I know it's the most competitive team in the world, and I know it could have gone either way of me being on the team, me not being on the team. So, you know, I'm excited for them. I'm going to be rooting them on to win gold. I was a kid that grew up watching the Olympics. So, yeah, it'll be fun to watch them.
What was your level of disappointment not hearing your name on the roster?
Honestly, no disappointment. Like, I think it just gives you something to work for. You know, that's a dream. You know, hopefully one day I can be there. And I think it's just a little more motivation. You remember that. And, you know, hopefully when 4 years comes back around, you know, I can be there.
Did you have a direct conversation with managing director or whoever's over there at USAB recently?
Yeah, they called me and let me know before everything came out, which was, you know, really respectful of them, and I appreciated that. And they did the same for every girl that made the team or every girl that didn't make the team. You know, there's a lot of players in the Olympic pool, so it wasn't like I was the only one they had to call. They had to make quite a few calls.
Are you looking forward to a break, you know, from Olympic action, basketball in general, I guess?
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to be really nice. I mean, I've loved competing every single second, but it's going to be a great month for my body to, you know, first of all, like, get rest and get healthy and just get a little time away from basketball and the craziness of everything that's been going on, and you know, just find some peace and quiet for myself. But then additionally, like, a great opportunity for us to work and get better, a great opportunity for myself to get in the weight room, to work on the court and work at things that I want to get better at that I maybe didn't have time going from college to the pro season. So I'm looking forward to it. But at the same time, like, we still have a month of games where we have a lot of opportunities to win a lot of games. So that's where my main focus is.
That's Caitlin Clark just reacting to the news that she was not selected for Team USA. And in her, you know, comments with the media, whether she's at the podium after a game or a setup like that, just with sort of the media gaggle that's there asking her questions afterwards. Not only a fellow Iowa Hawkeye, but just in all the work I do on Big Ten Radio and the Big Ten Network, covered in her entire college career. And if you follow me on social media, you know, as Coach Lisa Bluter, the now retired Coach Lisa Bluter, has led my Hawkeyes to back-to-back appearances in the national championship game. And we've been traveling both times that has taken place. 2 years ago or two seasons ago, my wife and our son, we were in Hawaii. So we made it a point to find a television at a bar, at a swim-up bar. We made sure we watched Iowa and LSU do battle in the national championship game then. And we made sure during our trip to Australia that we took in the road to the Final Four for the Hawkeyes and take in all the national championship game festivities while we were there on that trip. So huge Hawkeye fans. And the first athlete that our son could recognize by face, by jersey number, by name, was Caitlin Clark. Because of, you know, my wife also being a fellow Iowa alum and a Hawkeye athlete, we love watching Iowa Hawkeye sports in general. But then specifically to Caitlin Clark, she has, you know, this flair. And her game is eye-catching, especially as it was at the collegiate level. And so before my son could tell you who Justin Fields was, as much coverage as I do on the Bears here on this station and over on Fox 32, you know, he eventually could tell you, oh, Justin Fields wears number one, and he's the Bears quarterback. But he knew Caitlin Clark long before he could pick any other athlete out of a lineup. So we're quite the Caitlin Clark household. But to this current news, to this particular situation of Caitlin Clark being left off of Team USA, I think it makes perfect sense. It makes all the sense in the world. Now, the idea of growing the game and the international brand of USA women's basketball, I mean, it's a little bit short-sighted to just kind of assume that because Caitlin Clark is so remarkably popular here domestically that folks around the world are going to be anticipating the Caitlin Clark show, you know, when Team USA goes overseas. Because, yes, there is not another women's basketball player in the United States as popular as Caitlin Clark has become over the last couple of years here, between billboards and national ad campaigns and everything else. But it is the Olympic Games. Now, aside from NBC taking a bath during the COVID Olympics, you know, folks are going to show up. Folks are going to tune in. Folks are going to watch Team USA going for the gold in basketball, whether Caitlin Clark is there or not. Now, will Would there be an uptick in domestic eyeballs if Caitlin Clark were a part of the team? I suppose that's possible. But then, you know, when you look at some of the reporting out there from like Christine Brennan of USA Today and some of the reports there that she put out there about part of the reasoning for Caitlin Clark being left off the team apparently being that basically they didn't kind of want the distraction or the reaction that there would be from her likely getting limited minutes. Because when it comes down to it, she's not one of the best players on the planet right now. I believe that's the direction she's headed because, as we've seen, when you're anywhere near as dominant as Caitlin Clark was throughout her college basketball career, there's no reason to think her game won't end up transitioning to the WNBA to becoming successful. But she ain't there yet. So I don't see where Team USA should be viewed as being in the wrong for not adding her to the roster simply based off the idea that her popularity and the headlines that she's had here domestically will somehow translate over to Paris. Folks are going to show up to the Olympics. Folks are going to tune in and watch the Olympics. Like, you know, Patrick Mahomes is the quarterback for the Kansas City Chiefs was a big deal going to the Super Bowl. But if it was Brock Purdy versus Brock Purdy in the Super Bowl, folks were still going to tune in and watch the Super Bowl. But yes, Mahomes being there made a difference. It meant something for that part of the storyline as well. And Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift and all that part of things. Sure, that matters. It gives the broader audience an additional reason to tune in. But it's the Super Bowl, man. Folks are going to tune in. Folks are going to watch regardless of that. Folks will watch the Olympic Games regardless of Caitlin Clark being left off of Team USA. I would imagine this will be the last Olympic Games she does not take part in while she continues to play professional basketball because she's just that level of talent. But her game's not there yet. It will take a little bit of time. We have seen flashes of brilliance. We have seen her go off at 30 points here and there in her brief time in the WNBA. We have seen multiple times she's had 8 assists here, 7 assists there. Her court vision and her ball handling are exceptional. But her game will need to continue to be refined. I believe I'm very confident that's going to continue to happen. But her being left off of the Olympics, it's just one of those things that gives people something else to react to. But I feel like most of the outrage about it is kind of feigned outrage. It tends to be the case. I tend to view a lot of outrage about things, especially when it comes from social media, as folks just kind of putting on a show because they do feel like they need to have this big reaction to the biggest and most noteworthy sports figures and sports storylines that are out there. And there's not a lot that's moving the meter in the same way that Caitlin Clark is. But from a game perspective, her game itself does not warrant being on Team USA. You know, Arike Ogunbowale, her game warrants it. Kayla McBride, her game warrants it. They were left off of Team USA as well. So there's such a wide variety of special talents and exceptional players who make the team, some who don't make the team, who should be on there because of their game. And I don't believe that the sheer popularity of Caitlin Clark would be a proper reason to just put her on Team USA simply because they think a lot of folks will feel happy about it. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I think the proper decision was made. I'm guessing every Olympics from here on out that Caitlin Clark is healthy for and she's still playing basketball in the midst of, we're going to see her on Team USA from here on out because she is going to become an exceptional pro, just like she's been exceptional at every other level of the sport prior to this. Let's talk some more baseball. Let's get into the Cubs. We'll do that with Lance Brozdowski next here on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
Odyssey celebrates National Hispanic Heritage Month, brought to you by T-Mobile. You can count on T-Mobile to help you stay connected on America's largest 5G network.
We're back live with more Anthony Herron on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Ground ball to third. Christopher Morel got it. Cubs win. 4-2 the final as they take the finale here in Cincinnati.
South Sound on the Marquee Sports Network. Beth Mowen's on the call. Let's go back out to the hotline presented by Circa Sports. You guys join us on the Circa Resort and Casino Las Vegas hotline, CircaLasVegas.com. Because the Chicago Cubs are in a position that I think most of us thought there was a chance they'd be in, but man, didn't think it would look like this in a division that is not anticipated to be very deep. My conjecture coming in was that this division ain't running away from the Cubs. What's everybody all worried about? And now here they are in a three-way tie for being 6.5 games back of the Milwaukee Brewers. Let's go out to the hotline and welcome in Lance Brozdowski, see if we can get things figured out. What's happening with the North Side? As you can find him on Twitter at Lance Broz. Lance, what's happening? How you doing this evening?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, man. How are you?
I'm outstanding. Appreciate you taking the time to join me. And I want to start because I want to get to the pitching staff in a moment, but I do want to start with the Cubs offense because it seems that there have at least been some signs of life, some indications that certain individuals might be turning things around a little bit. It's just been very, very inconsistent. But let's start in particular with Ian Happ. Do you feel like what we've seen lately from Ian Happ would indicate that he's kind of back to himself, kind of getting back to the Ian Happ we expect at a consistent basis?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that he's back. I mean, I feel like sometimes we always run into this with guys at various points in the season. Like, you think of an ending slash line, right? Say a guy, like an Ian Happ, you know, posts like a 250, 350, 450 line, or maybe a little lower on the slug or something like that. How you get to that final slash line at the end of the year that you look back on and ultimately reflect on as you get into the offseason often doesn't encapsulate what the actual ride is like throughout the given season, right? There's ups and downs. It's really like there's very few players who are what you'd call almost like a metronome. Like I think like Freddie Freeman is being one of the only guys that's truly the same thing month in, month out. And the byproduct of that is that you run into ups and downs. And we just caught Ian Happ at the beginning of the year at somewhat of a down where he just, you know, underperformed relative to what he'd done prior in his career. And I think he's come out of that. Like you look at since the middle of May, slugging over 500, he's been relatively locked in. Like maybe the batting average is a little lower than career norms and OBP is a little lower. Maybe the league's adjusting to him. You know, maybe there's some aging taking place in his profile in terms of bat speed and stuff. But at the end of the day, like, he's there to get on base and slug for you, and he's done that since the middle of May. So we're getting to the point now where if you just split however many games he's played in half, you're looking at a net that is maybe a little below what he's done each of the last 2 years, but still one that if he continues on this stretch is going to net him a really consistent profile. He's going to end up being like a 10 to 20% above the league average hitter, and that's exactly why you have him in the lineup.
And with Christopher Morel, it's been talked for a few weeks now about the approach at the plate and the adjustments and improvements that have been made in his tendencies in the box. It hasn't necessarily consistently turned into the sort of pop and power that we know is within him. One thing I do like, though, is that when there's opportunities late in game, he doesn't seem to shy away from that at all. So up to this point in the season, how would you evaluate the development or the evolution of Christopher Morel?
Yeah, I think if you went into the season and told me that after 65-ish games or whatever they've played, you know, Morel's strikeout rate would be, what is it, 10%, 10 percentage points lower. He was above 30 last year. Now he's kind of hovering around 20. If you told me that, I would have expected him to be clear all-star and a guy that maybe is even in the MVP consideration. Because the reality is he's such a good power hitter that if you're telling me he retained that and the strikeouts came down, that's how you make, like, leaps at the age of 25. The thing is that's really odd about his profile is that the slug has come down, I think, more than everyone expected. Now, you run into some bad luck with him. You know, he had a ball in Milwaukee, Blake Purdon's caught. He had a ball that hung up in PNC that I still don't really understand what happened to the ball because it was absolutely torched and it just hung up in center field and Michael Taylor made a catch. You have some what you could call bad luck based on the exit velocity and launch angle that he's hitting the ball in certain instances. So I think in terms of underperformance of slug, he is one of the guys I think in the league, if you look at from May 1st, who's going to catch up and at some point the slug on the season will very much get above the 380-ish it is right now. I think he's projected probably for like a 450 slug going forward, and he's got like a 380 slug right now. So that's a big gap, 60-point gap there. And I'm pretty confident he's going to end up being that going forward from a slug perspective. The thing is just getting all of it to align, right? The discipline has gotten better. He's not swinging outside the zone as much. He's understanding where in the zone he could do damage. You align all that alongside being able to barrel the ball at an above-average rate for a hitter, and you run into a really, really productive offensive player. We just haven't seen the encapsulation of that for more than, a week or two. We saw it at the beginning of the year, then there was a hard downturn, and it's come back up from a batted ball quality standpoint. But again, the results are not showing up. So again, I'm not trying to be Mr. Optimist here, but so far the two guys you mentioned are guys that I'm pretty confident are going to turn it around. It's just you're running into like odd stretches, and I'm not entirely sure why. I mean, Burrell's, his foot, if anyone's watched, you know, on Marquee or any of the games, he's fouled so many balls off his foot. There could be lingering stuff on that. Like, guys are banged up. You know, you always hear at the end of the year or the off season, like, oh, yeah, he was working through this for 2 months of the year. Then you go look at those 2 months, and it's like, oh, those just happened to be the 2 months that he was underperforming. So I'm hopeful that, you know, the bad luck on the health side turns around alongside the bad luck on the power side, and we're looking at a new and improved Chris Morel by the end of the year.
All right, Mr. Optimist. Convince me that Patrick Wisdom is the leadoff hitter the Cubs need.
All right, so yeah, that one maybe I'm not as strongly optimistic.
Fair, I'm going to test you.
Yeah, that's a good test. I get the rationale in those two situations, right? Like Andrew Abbott and Nick Lodolo, that's the two guys he started against, and I think was the 0-for-9 or something like that. From a large big data perspective, you know, pulling in the analysts, going to Craig Counsell, and like he's obviously a numbers guy and he's thinking about these things. Wisdom historically over the last couple of years was really good versus left-handed pitching. I do think sometimes maybe where the numbers can mess you up is looking at that and assuming that it will continue when I think in the week prior, Wisdom started like one game. That balance of being able to pinch hit periodically coming into games and then starting consecutive games against, I think, two pretty good left-handed pitchers. Like Lodolo is funky crossfire guy. Andrew Abbott doesn't have good stuff, but he's overperformed his peripherals for his entire career. So there's something going on there from a visual standpoint that I would bet continues for him. Two pretty good pitchers. I get it's a park that is one of the best at allowing home runs. So you're just hoping that he lucks into a homer in one of those nine-ish or at-bats or whatever. But he didn't. So, I get it from the large sample perspective of, like, he's great versus left-handed pitching, and we don't really have anyone else that is going to solve the problem of Nick Lodolo or Andrew Abbott confidently enough from the right side. So let's put Wisdom there and see what happens. It just didn't pan out. And I would chalk it up to like wondering whether he just hadn't played as much consecutively to be locked in for those plate appearances against two really good lefties. So while I get the understanding, while I get the rationale around it, I don't necessarily maybe agree with it. But then again, I don't really know what the alternative would have been in those situations. So I don't know. You go like contact up top and hope that someone just gets on. I don't mind the idea of like laying into the power hitter and trying to slug at the ballpark that inflates slug almost more than anywhere else that isn't Coors. So I'm a little more torn on that one. I don't know what the alternative is, but I get the decision making behind it. I imagine you're not totally into it though.
I'm not, especially when Ian Happ has done it before. And yes, there were some fits and starts the last time he really had a consistent opportunity at it either. But between he and Wisdom, I feel like Happ would be my preferred option there. No?
Yeah, I don't mind. I mean, Happ's right-handed swing is one that I know he always talks about. And, you know, Elise and Taylor for Sideline for Us always do reporting on that. I feel like every year we end up talking about he's tinkering with it or whatnot, you know. I guess that would be the move if you want to play from the side of he's been in the lineup consistently seeing good pitching such that, you know, maybe he would be the guy to sit up top there. But at the same time, like, you got to get probably Patrick Wisdom in the lineup at some point against those lefties because the slug's so good. It's just, it's tough. It's tough for me to overanalyze sometimes the decision that we only get two games to make a sample of. Like, you go to the ballpark a random day, and you might run into Shohei Ohtani going 0-for-8, you know, in a two-game stretch. It's like, does that mean he's a bad hitter? Like, no, not necessarily. It just means that you caught some variance that causes you to not see a good Shohei Ohtani. And I don't want to say that's the case we're running into with Wisdom, right? But historically in his career, he's been pretty good versus left-handed pitching, so I don't mind it. I just think those were two really good left-handed pitchers, and I think that won out in this particular two-game set.
Lance Brozdowski, my guest here on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. You can find him on Twitter at Lance Broz. He's the player development analyst for the Marquee Sports Network. Let's get to the pitching staff. And I've taken to calling Shota Imanaga Showtime Imanaga, and I really enjoy every time he takes the mound and when he's out there, the sort of vibrant nature, the energy that he exudes and the joy that he seems to pitch the ball with. It was good to see him be able to end this slide for the Cubs. It was a big win for him, a big moment for the Cubs to at least get one against the Reds. So does that mean Showtime is back?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is you look at the first, what was that, 8 starts or so of his, 9 starts of his career. Like, he's not going to be a sub-1 ERA pitcher, 1.5 ERA pitcher, you know? Like, if he does that over 150 innings, you're talking about it in relation to one of the best pitching seasons of all time, right?
Lance, so you got negative really quick, man. Jeez.
I'm not getting negative. I'm trying to be realistic here. You know what I mean? Like, he's not a 1.5. No one in baseball is a 1.5 ERA pitcher. DeGrom, what's DeGrom's career ERA? Kershaw's career ERA? They're all, like, 2.5 plus, you know?
Yeah.
So the reality is, like, you run into a really hot stretch, and I just expected some correction to happen, you know? And he ran into that for two starts, an odd one against Chicago, and then in Milwaukee, that was a tough start as well. And I thought he pitched pretty well in Cincinnati, you know? I think his repertoire and approach is very simple, anyone that's watched him. You watch him in the WBC, you saw more of a mix. Mixing some cutter, threw the sweeper more, you know, played, I think, with a sinker there, at least tried to. Over here, it's been fastball split. That's it. I'm up and down. I'm very north-south, and there's nothing else going on in my repertoire. And at some point, that, even if it's coming from a lefty, you know, I do think lefties buy the ability to have reduced repertoires a bit more than righties just because of the angles and et cetera. You saw it like a Nick Lodola, but even a Nick Lodola has a changeup too. Steele is a good example here, right? Like, he dominated last year basically with two pitches. But even this year, you're seeing more sinkers to lefties. He's throwing a couple changeups every game, you know? You see some development of him as a pitcher. I just think Shota's going to run into that in a season as opposed to, you know, running the Steele situation where he runs hot for an entire year and then now has to make adjustments. So going forward, I'm curious on how he adjusts. You saw in the Chicago start in particular, he really started pitching inside with his four-seam varieties more than he had prior. That was a bit of a novel thing. It kind of stuck with Cincinnati. Curious to see if they start splitting that fastball into a couple locations as opposed to just being like, hey, up in the zone all the time. Like, maybe we try to pitch inside a little bit. Maybe we try to go up with it. Splitting locations on an individual pitch, I think it's kind of like a cheat code way to get multiple pitches out of it without introducing a brand new pitch. You've seen some sinkers with him. He threw a couple in Boston, I remember, in a start. Kind of hasn't totally gone with that pitch a ton, primarily because he doesn't face a lot of left-handed hitters. But I wonder what the development of the repertoire becomes. Is there a cutter? Is there something else? Does he throw the sweeper more? Does he try to maybe create some kind of bridge slider that works versus righties? There's more to the mix, you know, and we saw that in the WBC. It's just a matter of when the Cubs are comfortable rolling that out over time and if, you know, they want to wait for this regression to come and then do it. But I'm confident he's going to be above league average pitcher going forward. You know, his ERA is just below 2 right now. I think on the season, it might end up just below 3. So you're going to run into some more damage. I'm a little worried because he's such a fly ball dependent pitcher. You're going to run into some starts at Wrigley where if some balls just get up and get out versus him. So, you know, he had a huge home run problem overseas and that hasn't really totally manifested. So we might run into some starts where he's given up multiple home runs, but I still think the net of him as a pitcher is going to be very good. And especially for the price they got him for, it's still one of the steals of the offseason to me.
You mentioned Justin Steele's name a moment ago, and it feels like it's been good to see that he's starting to get more consistent every time he takes the mound here. Is the 2023 version of Justin Steele, is that still in there waiting to emerge somewhere, or is the guy we've seen the last few starts kind of enough for the Cubs to help continue to build winning around?
Oh, I think the present state of Justin Steele is definitely enough for the Cubs to build around. The interesting thing with him is that his fastball shape changed a bit from last year, so he's a guy, if you watch him, it's hard to see sometimes from camera angles, but lefties, you know, he cuts the ball a lot. His ball cuts more than you'd expect. If you were, like, standing over his left shoulder as he was delivering the ball, it wouldn't be running away from a righty as much as it would for a normal pitcher. His ball kind of would stay more true on that line. This year, what we've seen since he's come back from the hammy injury is that he's behind the ball more. So the ball has more lift to it and less of that cut. It looks more like a standard fastball as opposed to this weird kind of four-seam cutter hybrid pitch that he was throwing a lot last year. Is that intentional? I'm not entirely sure. I haven't got a chance to talk to him. They've been on the road for a bit. I'm planning on asking him to just kind of see if it's byproducts of something changing in the delivery post-hammy injury. Is it something he's comfortable with? You know, it hasn't impeded him, I think, a ton, but it is different. It is a different look on that individual pitch. You know, I think especially going glove side, going like into right-handed hitters, because this pitch isn't cutting as much, there's a little more risk that it ends in leaks back over the plate. That, I think, could be a bit of an issue, but at the same time, he still has the ability to ride the ball up away from righties. Maybe they kind of just become a little more aggressive with their targeting, inner third to righties. So that, for him, is a fundamentally different shape for me. I was looking at this with Joe Girardi, too, and he backed it up, than we saw last year for him. So that's something to monitor, in my opinion. I don't know if it's a problem, I would say, but I still love him as a pitcher. I just think it's such a unique look, even with the less unique of a fastball that he's currently showing. It's still just a nasty slider. I love the evolution of the sinker. I think his changeup's kind of sneaky good on the ones he's thrown. I'd love to see that more. I know it's weird to be like, hey, man, you were great last year throwing like 95% fastball slider. Let's not do that, and let's throw something else that, you know, we don't totally know how it plays against righties. But I would love to see that pitch usage come up a bit. You know, you look at a guy like Lodolo, like Lodolo's changeup is like 18-20%. Like, that's a fundamental part of his repertoire. So I'm not saying that Steele's going to become a Lodolo. Like, he's a different kind of pitcher in terms of the fastball shape and stuff. But I'd love to see long-term Justin Steele become a guy that's comfortable throwing the changeup 10% of the time to righties and refine that pitch over time.
And we have seen throughout this season in baseball where the more off-speed and changeups have become a bigger part of the repertoire of the league as a whole, right?
For sure. I mean, fastball rates are down. You look at the beginning of the year, we're currently tracking to have the individual team since the pitch tracking era started with the lowest fastball usage of, I think you could say, all time. Like, you don't even need to say in the pitch tracking era, because there's no way that an organization as a team at any year prior to 2015 was throwing like 40%, or I think it's like 35% right now, sub 35% fastball. So combined four-seam and sinker usage. That's the Boston Red Sox right now. Like, we're in an era where teams are realizing that fastballs give up a lot of damage, and why throw them if we have alternatives that will not give as much damage? You know, this is, it's funny, Breslow used to be in the Cubs organization, obviously is now over there, brings over Andrew Bailey, who the Giants are a team that completely went away from forcing fastball usage as a whole. And I mean, him and Breslow and Bailey seem to be somewhat hive-minded in Boston, and they're very much moving away from that. And I'll admit, that's very different than the Cub team. The Cub team, I think right now, in terms of fastball usage, is third or fourth in the league, I want to say, on a staff level, so their entire pitching staff, how much fastball do you throw? So you think about like the contrast in perspective between those two teams and where Breslow went. It's just interesting to think about. It could be a personnel thing, obviously. You know, there's some unique fastballs on the Cubs that I think justify the usage, but the league as a whole is moving away from the fastball. I don't think we've hit the bottom of fastball usage. I think we're going to see more teams push away from it.
With Ben Brown, whether it's as a starter or a reliever, he certainly had some really impressive moments. But you do wonder, okay, he's 24 years old, most extended action he's gotten at the major league level. What are you seeing from Brown as of late, and are you seeing anything worthy of concern?
No, I like Ben Brown a lot. I think I'm dropping Joe Girardi twice in here just because we had him in all week. But he and I did a segment where we talked about, like, what's the next step for Brown. And we played around with some ideas. He came down on either throwing the changeup more or adding some kind of split to be more confident in to throw both lefties and righties. I like adding a sinker for him. So his four-seam fastball is good because it's hard, but the shape of it doesn't necessarily work super well versus right-handed hitters. This goes back to last year as well. The, like, expected damage he's allowing on the pitch is really good versus lefties, and then it's not great versus righties. I think it's really low-hanging fruit if they want to keep him as a starter to just play around something moving hard inside on righties. I know the fastball has a bit of tail, but I'd love to see them throw in some kind of sinker there. It's just another wrinkle. Help him protect things in the outer third of the plate. I bet it would help the forcing play up. I bet it will help the curveball outer third play up. I also love Joe's idea of the splitter or throwing changeup more. You know, threw it, I think, a couple times in his last start in Cincinnati, but overall, it's still not a pitch that he uses a ton, which I get because the curveball is really good and the shape of it works versus either-handedness. You say that's platoon neutral, so there's not too much of a need, so to speak, to move off that pitch. But you think, like, turning over lineups, wanting him to go multiple times through, like, there's other pitches in there, I think, and he has the aptitude to learn them. He's a super sharp guy. I love talking to him in the clubhouse. He's one of my favorite guys to just chat general pitching with. But, yeah, it's a question of, you know, Wicks now in the pen. Ben Brown's had a bit of a hot streak. If Brown runs into maybe two more starts of issues, do they flip those roles? Kind of remains to be seen. I bet internally they don't even really know what they're going to do. But I like Brown. I think he's a starting pitcher. I don't think the best thing for him developmentally is to just make him a reliever rest of the season. I want him to develop as a starter because that's where you capitalize on the most upside he can have as a player.
It does seem that some of the uncertainty that you referenced there can really be, I guess, associated with the trade deadline as well when that time comes about. And the amount of injuries that the Cubs have dealt with this season can make that trickier, you know, to just try and decide what they do with this roster. How do you think they go about that? Is there a particular area or position that you think the Cubs are most likely to attack to try and enhance the roster moving forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. I kind of just started thinking about this, so I don't think I have like fully developed thoughts. But I'll say as an organization, they're very rich in prospects. And I'd say a lot of those prospects, if you were to look at the major league roster construction, don't have spots. You know, like they've had trouble getting PCA in the lineup. And that was one of the guys I thought that would very obviously find and play his way into a spot. You know, Talkman's been playing well. Kudos to him. Long-term, PCA is the center fielder of this team. And I think at some point down the road, later this season, et cetera, he just needs to play every single day. But you look at other guys, like Owen Casey, I love at AAA, hits the ball crazy, crazy hard. I think he's an interesting bat to find some spot in the major leagues, but it's just, I don't know where you play him. Like, yeah, Hap left, Suzuki in right, Bush is DH first base, Belly plays first base occasionally, mixes that around. You know, it's tough. You have a lot of, I don't want to say redundant pieces, but when you look in the minor leagues as to who can help exactly now, you run into, I don't want to say roadblocks, but you do run into some roadblocks. And that causes two things. Either A, you have to trade the guys at the major league level that are under contract that maybe you're comfortable trading or you can get a team to take salary on. The other option is just to trade the guys that are blocked, right? You saw the Dodgers do this with Michael Bush. They did not have a spot for Michael Bush. You know, he couldn't really play defensively for them. They didn't really like him in that respect. So they ship him out and they pick up a non-40 arm in Jackson Ferris, who was drafted in, what was that, 22 out of IMG Academy. And, you know, now he's carving for them in the minor leagues, but he doesn't have to be added to the 40 man for a while. That's kind of the exact situation that I could see playing out for the Cubs. And the question becomes how good they are competitive-wise late in the year and whether they're going after a guy that can help them right now because they want to make a postseason run. Because at the end of the day, all you got to kind of do is get in. We saw that last year with the Diamondbacks. Or whether they want to convert that into a guy that's not on the 40-man roster and do, like, I don't want to say a soft rebuild, but maybe combo up a couple moves where you have a rebuild-style move where you pick up a good arm you like in the minors, but then you also trade maybe a major league piece and a prospect, and you pick up a piece with a couple years of control. That's the tough part, though. I think you run into, like, rental markets at the deadline. You don't really run into situations where teams are willing to trade controllable prospects, or excuse me, controllable major league players. So Garrett Crochet pops to mind. I love Garrett Crochet. I think he's one of the best pitchers in baseball. Are the Cubs willing to, like, shell out for him? Like, you could have him for another year and really make 2025 the year. You could also have him for this postseason run. I think he might be better than Steele, I think, on a per-inning basis as a pitcher. Again, much less experience there, but his upside looks exceptional. So I think there's a lot of ways this could play out. I think it's one of those things. You saw some rumors that they're talking to the Blue Jays about Vlad Guerrero Jr. Like, that's interesting. I also think it's funny that Vlad Guerrero played third base for the first time in 4 years or whatever was it. Like, that's clearly them trying him out there just to get the value up from a trade perspective, I would imagine. So we'll see, man. Like, it's a great question. I think you need another, like, month and a half of games to figure out what the current state of the Cubs team is. Because I do right now think it's kind of up in the air. 2 games under 500, 6.5 out of the division. The wild card is an absolute mess. You know, they're very much in play for a playoff spot. Anyone who thinks otherwise, I think, is crazy. Just because the third wild card right now is just a hodgepodge of teams. In the 2 months, we might be looking at just completely different everything. You know, maybe the Cubs jump up a little, maybe they fall. And that, I think, will dictate what they do at the deadline.
For whatever reason, and it doesn't make all the sense in the world, there have been other pitching transactions between the two ball clubs in town here since Jose Quintana. But for whatever reason, man, Garrett Crochet, Jose Quintana comes to mind when I think about that potential for the Cubs acquiring him. You know, it probably shouldn't be a corollary, but it is something I'm guessing Cubs fans might have a little concern about as well from the not too distant past. I know you will break it down as well as anyone does for any of the transactions that might take place in baseball in this town. Appreciate you joining me, Lance.
Thanks a ton, man. Have a good night.
That is Lance Brozdowski of the Marquee Sports Network on X at Lance Broz. There's some basketball news that happened earlier that, to me, had all the makings of a red herring from when the news first broke, and that's exactly what it turned out to be. I'll tell you what I'm talking about as I close the show next on The Score.
We're back live with more Anthony Herron on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
A red herring is defined as something that misleads or distracts from a relevant or important question. Maybe either a logical fallacy or a literacy device that leads readers or audience toward a false conclusion. So the reports circulated, Adrian Wojnarowski ended up breaking it. I suppose breaking it is a bit of a loose term in this case. But late last week, reports surfaced from Woj. Woj bomb went out. The Lakers are pursuing Dan Hurley of UConn. And they were going to offer him huge money to make him the next coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. There was talk about how, you know, LeBron James had tweeted positive things about Dan Hurley in the past, and you know, how Dan Hurley was ready for the NBA, how his style of play would end up sort of coalescing with the IQ of LeBron, the court vision of LeBron, the distribution that really can be exceptional when you look at some of the recent NBA champions and his style being able to be something that would work there. And the Lakers usually wanting a splash in their head coach. So got the big brand of the Los Angeles Lakers going to get the hottest name from college basketball. We know that Bulls coach Billy Donovan was a guy who was an exceptional, a two-time national champion as a college basketball coach before eventually moving on to the NBA. And now he's been in the NBA for pretty much as long as he's been, as he was a college basketball coach. When I talked about this on my Big Ten radio show on SiriusXM last week, though, when the news first came out, I said right off the bat, Dan Hurley ain't going nowhere. They won the last two national championships at UConn, and the Huskies have a brand where any coach who goes there has shown themselves capable over the last basically 30 years of putting a national championship caliber product on the court. So, yes, a lot of folks are reacting to a lot of the recent evolution in college sports and saying, oh, all these coaches are running away to go do something else. And look at the transfer portal chasing all these guys away. None of it makes sense. It's not true. If you got options, sure, you go pursue another, maybe even a better job. But there's nothing wrong with being a college basketball coach. So Dan Hurley is going to take $20 million less to stay at UConn as opposed to going and coaching at the highest level. I saw it coming a mile away. I also saw the end of this show coming a few minutes ago. My thanks to Zach Pearson, to Steve Stone, to Lance Brozdowski. Also thanks to my guy, Tyler Butterball, on the ones and twos for me throughout the evening. As always, of course, I thank you as well for being here with me throughout this evening. I'm Anthony Herron. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Big Ant Herron. Spend my time here with you. Appreciations and salutations for listening in to Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
We're back live with more Anthony Herron on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
A red herring is defined as something that misleads or distracts from a relevant or important question. Maybe either a logical fallacy or a literacy device that leads readers or audience toward a false conclusion. So the reports circulated, Adrian Wojnarowski ended up breaking it. I suppose breaking it is a bit of a loose term in this case. But late last week, reports surfaced from Woj. Woj bomb went out. The Lakers are pursuing Dan Hurley of UConn. And they were going to offer him huge money to make him the next coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. There was talk about how, you know, LeBron James had tweeted positive things about Dan Hurley in the past, and you know, how Dan Hurley was ready for the NBA, how his style of play would end up sort of coalescing with the IQ of LeBron, the court vision of LeBron, the distribution that really can be exceptional when you look at some of the recent NBA champions and his style being able to be something that would work there. And the Lakers usually wanting a splash in their head coach. So got the big brand of the Los Angeles Lakers going to get the hottest name from college basketball. We know that Bulls coach Billy Donovan was a guy who was an exceptional, a two-time national champion as a college basketball coach before eventually moving on to the NBA. And now he's been in the NBA for pretty much as long as he's been, as he was a college basketball coach. When I talked about this on my Big Ten radio show on SiriusXM last week, though, when the news first came out, I said right off the bat, Dan Hurley ain't going nowhere. They won the last two national championships at UConn, and the Huskies have a brand where any coach who goes there has shown themselves capable over the last basically 30 years of putting a national championship caliber product on the court. So, yes, a lot of folks are reacting to a lot of the recent evolution in college sports and saying, oh, all these coaches are running away to go do something else. And look at the transfer portal chasing all these guys away. None of it makes sense. It's not true. If you got options, sure, you go pursue another, maybe even a better job. But it's nothing wrong with being a college basketball coach. So Dan Hurley is going to take $20 million less to stay at UConn as opposed to going and coaching at the highest level. I saw it coming a mile away. I also saw the end of this show coming a few minutes ago. My thanks to Zach Pearson, to Steve Stone, to Lance Brozdowski. Also thanks to my guy, Tyler Butterball, and the ones and twos for me throughout the evening. As always, of course. I thank you as well for being here with me throughout this evening. I'm Anthony Herron. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Big Ant Herron. Spend my time here with you. Appreciations and salutations for listening in to Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
Odyssey celebrates National Hispanic Heritage Month, brought to you by T-Mobile. You can count on T-Mobile to help you stay connected on America's largest 5G network.